You are now listening to the eWatchmen podcast with your host, Robert King.
Everyone, welcome to another edition of the Watchman's Post podcast. This program was recorded on October the 18th, I believe, in the year 2011. Well, I have a few questions here, and this may be an abbreviated program. I had intended to do a program earlier in the day. My sister's coming to visit from the U.S., and arriving this evening, and I've got to go pick her up at the airport. But yeah, she had been a caregiver for my father in his final years, and so now that he's passed, she's able to do a little traveling. So she's coming, and we're going to go to France for a few days, her and my wife. And so anyway, I wanted to do a program before she got here and before we leave, but this morning, a water pipe burst in the house, in the upstairs bathroom, and water cascading down through the tiles, you know, in the ceiling, and it was a bit of a mess. We're just leasing a house, you know, and I'd had a plumber out who knew the house a few days ago, and I just offhandedly asked him where the main water shutoff was in case there was a catastrophe. And lo and behold, he told me it was on the outside of the fence by the curb, but I still didn't know exactly where. So I was out there frantically kicking leaves out of the way, all the autumn leaves. And it took me a few minutes, but I found it and got the water shut off and have been mopping up and washing and drying towels all afternoon. So my day was sort of ruined. Anyway, I wanted to, like I say, put a program together. I don't know when I'll have another opportunity. It'll probably be a couple of weeks. But it's good to be talking with you now. And as you know, the format of the program, I take callers and emailer questions. And we have a caller question. Let me pop it in the editor and play it right now.
Hello, Mr. King. I was calling inquiring about the writing of the Gospels, the four Gospels of the Bible. When I did some research, I discovered that they were written approximately 90 to 100 years after Christ had lived and died. And my question to you is, being the time frame, the time elapse between the writing of the Gospels and the presence of Christ, what is your opinion of the accuracy of the writings? I look forward to hear what you have to say about this, and thank you very much. Bye.
All right. Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know where you did your research. It is true that the Gospels were not written until some years later, but it wasn't on the order of 100 or 130 years. That would have been beyond the lifetime of the disciples and the apostles. For instance, John was one of the writers. That would have made him, you know, 150 years old, which is not the case. But the Gospel of John, for example, was written about 70 years after Christ. But Matthew's gospel, I think, was written as recently as 10 years, and Luke and Mark something in the order of 20 to 30 years later. What's good to keep in mind, we have to sort of use our imagination and realize that our world is much different than the world that existed during the time of Christ. Our world is much different than the world that existed 100 years ago. People didn't have, you know, electronic media, and newspapers have only been around, you know, a few hundred years, books, a similar period. Before that, people did not write. paper was rare. You know, they used animal skins and papyrus paper. And mostly people communicated orally. And, you know, they didn't have television. They didn't sit around in the evening watching TV or, you know, playing with a computer or anything like that. What they did was they told stories. People were storytellers. And family history was passed on that way, and world history. You know, there are still stories being told to this day in, you know, ancient cultures about a flood that inundated the earth thousands of years ago, in which our great ancestors survived. So people, I think, probably had trained their memories to recall things better as well, because that it was so important, because you didn't have, you know, a dictation machine or access to a computer or writing. And so people remembered things better. Our memory is like a muscle, right? And the more you exercise it, the stronger it gets. And, of course, when the Christians would come to their meetings, come to the congregation, they would likely hear stories told about what Christ said and did. And as I say, all the apostles were eyewitnesses, and there were many other eyewitnesses as well that heard, for example, his Sermon on the Mount. Some of the Pharisees, you know, dined with Jesus privately, and the Bible says that a good number of Pharisees and priests eventually became Christians. And so they would have their memories and could give witness to what Jesus said on a particular occasion when maybe the apostles weren't there and things of that nature. I would like to read to you the opening words of the Gospel of Luke. And he touches on this very thing as far as the oral history being passed on. He says, "Whereas many have undertaken to compile a statement of the facts that are given full credence among us, just as those who from the beginning became eyewitnesses and attendants of the message delivered these to us, I resolved also, because I have traced all things from the start with accuracy, to write them in logical order to you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know fully the certainty of the things that you have been taught orally." So it's interesting that Luke says that many had undertaken to compile a statement of the facts. So these oral stories were being passed along from eyewitness accounts from the apostles and disciples. And many, apparently, had undertaken to collect these things together and write them down. So Luke, being a doctor and an intelligent man and a researcher, endeavored to gather all the available written statements and eyewitnesses and put it in a logical order from the birth of Christ to his ascension to heaven. And he claims to have done it, traced all things, he said, with accuracy. It's interesting, too, that Matthew was a tax collector, and he would have had to have been a man given to details and to note, you know, with precision, you know, the facts and figures. And so Jehovah used him to do the same thing. So when we actually, you know, compare the Gospels, there are minor discrepancies. But rather than that be an indication that of inaccuracy or that it was uninspired, it really indicates that the writers of the Gospel did not collude. You know, hey, let's make sure our stories harmonize. You know, they obviously didn't do that. There are minor differences that some people have grasped upon, but I remember the Watchtower addressed some of these issues in an older publication. Is the Bible really the Word of God? And one of these supposedly contradictions, one of the gospel writers had mentioned that as Jesus was coming out of Jericho, he met some lepers. Another gospel writer said, as Jesus was coming into Jericho. So which was it? He was coming out of Jericho or he was going in? Somebody's wrong, right? Well, not necessarily. The Watchtower pointed out that recent archaeological findings show that Jericho was a twin city, sort of like, you know, St. Paul, Minneapolis, or Dallas-Fort Worth, only on a much smaller scale. So apparently, Jesus was in between the two cities. He was coming out of one part of the town and going into another, and it depended on your perspective whether he was coming out of Jericho or going in. Yeah. Anyway, I hope that satisfies your concern on the issue, the fact that people did have, I think, a much greater capacity for memory, and there were many, many eyewitnesses, and these stories were told and told within the congregation, and when new members would come in, they'd have to hear the story of Christ, and they'd be curious. And so there were many, many eyewitnesses who also endeavored to write these things down, and then God used the four writers to compile all these things. Some of them were eyewitnesses themselves, like Matthew and John, whereas Luke was not an eyewitness, but apparently he interviewed many who were and compiled all the facts and accurately recorded them for us. All right, so got a few questions here from the email, Hopper. Somebody writes about Fritz Springmeier. He just wanted to get your insight on the comments made by Fritz Springmeier. He sends me a link, and he says it's about 1 minute into the video. He calls out the Watchtower as having a connection with the Illuminati as well as the Mormon Church. How could this allegation be verified? Well, it can't, obviously, and I would question how some guy in Oregon, you know, has the inside info on the Illuminati. I don't even know if there is such a thing as the Illuminati. I mean, how can anyone be sure unless you were an insider? And if you were an insider, you would be sworn to secrecy. Yeah. But the world is definitely run by a very wealthy elitist families, mostly in Europe. And they are members of a secret society, whether you call it the Illuminati or whatever. Some call it Freemasonry, the upper levels, and they've used Freemasonry, the lower levels, as sort of a recruiting ground for people that, you know, to do their bidding, their dirty work for them. I would, you know, Fritz Springmeier is, you know, a right wing. He's like a Ted Kaczynski guy. He went to prison for blowing up a bank back in the 90s. As a matter of fact, I came across his book. I used to live in the Pacific Northwest. I know, I've lived all over the place. But anyway, I was in a secondhand bookstore, and his book must have just come out. This is back in the 90s. And, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses are the Watchtower and the Masons. I didn't buy it, but I spent about 10, 15 minutes standing there reading through it pretty quickly. Interestingly, I mean, I would pretty much discount, well, I was going to say, but, you know, Springmeier, you have to question his objectivity. He apparently is a evangelical type, and he accuses the Watchtower of heresy for rejecting, you know, what he calls the scriptural truth of hellfire and all that kind of nonsense. So, and as far as the bloodlines of the Illuminati, supposedly Russell is part of the 13 bloodlines, I don't buy into that. But what I have spoken about and written about is that the Watchtower has obviously been infiltrated by enemy agents, And you can take Jesus' word at that. You know, what did he say? While men were sleeping, the devil oversowed the field with weeds, right? And Jesus spoke about, you know, the faithful slave and the unfaithful slave. And Jesus spoke about the man of lawlessness who is empowered by the devil to try to overreach Jehovah's servants. So obviously, if the watchtower was a rallying point for anointed persons, which I believe it was, that Jehovah gathered them together and has accomplished his work through these ones, he has also allowed Satan to get a foothold. He did the same thing in the first century. I mean, come on, Judas Iscariot was an agent of the devil. He was one of the 12 apostles, the superfine apostles of the Corinthian congregation. Paul called them out, you know, and said that they were agents of the devil, basically, that Satan turns himself into an angel of light. So Jehovah, you know, allows this to go on, but it doesn't mean that the watchtower is not Jehovah's instrument. Maybe not to the extent that Jehovah's Witnesses believe. You know, I've fought tooth and nail to try to get Jehovah's Witnesses to wake up to the falsity of 1914 and how it is the operation of error that Jehovah has allowed Satan to perform to convince Jehovah's Witnesses of a fake parousia. By the way, I went to the Kingdom Hall last Sunday. I don't know what got into me. I woke up and go see what they have to say. A talk on Armageddon. It was one of the newer outlines, but it was the same old, you know. Anyway, as I was leaving, one of the elders followed me out. And I'd spoken to him before when I went to the memorial, and he's very kindly older brother. And you know, he said, if you ever want to talk, you know, I'll give you my phone number, and you know, I'd like to help you, get back in the organization and all that. And I just told him straight out. I said, well, you know, I have irresolvable differences with the Watchtower, and I said, I just don't believe that the invisible parousia began in 1914. And he said, well, look, you know, just like with the talk today, you know, look at all the things that have been happening since 1914. And I said, yeah. I said, are you saying that there cannot be another war, that there cannot be massive food shortages? I said, look at the world now. I said, the United States is preparing to launch World War III with nuclear weapons. And he says, well, let's hope not. Be positive, brother. Oh, so what are you going to do? I thanked him for his kindness, but the blindness is just impenetrable because, they put so much faith in the watchtower. The watchtower cannot be wrong. In the minds of Jehovah's Witnesses, there is no possible way that Jehovah would allow it. And yet the scriptures show clearly that Jehovah does allow it. He does allow Satan some influence, and it's up to us to protect ourselves from it and not allow ourselves to be deceived. One of the primary things Jesus warned about when he gave the sign of the conclusion, see that you are not misled. And he focused more on that than he did, you know, the big stuff, the wars and, right? Many will say, I am he. The due time is approached. Do not believe it. Here is the Christ. Do not go out. He's in the inner chambers. Nada. Don't fall for it. But Jehovah's Witnesses are in a position where they have been deceived, and when the real, authentic parousia begins, then there's going to be a massive test of faith. And yes, going back to Russell, I don't have the insight, and to me, it doesn't really matter to figure out the who and the what and the how, whether the Masons or the Illuminati. There is obviously a satanic footprint with all of the paganism that was inherent in the organization initially, the Masonic cross and crown on the watchtower and the winged sun and all that. Those are definitely connected with Masonry and the occult. and in more recent times, the subliminals. There is a satanic influence, like I say. And when Jesus spoke to the symbolic seven congregations that would be in existence during the Lord's day, he spoke of the influence of Jezebel and Balaam within two of the congregations, who were teaching his slaves to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit adultery. And I think in a spiritual sense, that's what the Watchtower has done. It has misled Jehovah's Witnesses into a form of idolatry and idolizing the organization. And with their NGO connection, they have committed spiritual adultery. And all of Jehovah's Witnesses, or at least those who were publishers for those 10 years from 92 to 2001, they participated in disseminating literature that had been written specifically to praise the UN organization. So in a very subtle way, like Balaam tried to get and succeeded in getting some of the Israelites to commit literal fornication and adultery, this secret Balaam-like influence in the organization has done a very similar thing in a spiritual way. But we're going to see Jehovah's judgment soon. I'm certain of that. The world can't go on in its present state. And the people running the show know that. They're positioning themselves. The financial system can only be held aloft a little longer. So they're preparing to launch shock and awe, martial law, to blow the world up, to go after China and Russia so they cannot develop, you know, any sort of cohesive, you know, alliance that would survive the collapse of the Anglo-American system. We're at that point. A few months. I doubt if it'll go another year, but we're there. What do you think about the Watchtower forbidding things not forbidden in the Bible? So I know that some of the things the Watchtower forbids are not in the Bible, like saying a toast or blessing someone after they sneeze. I found some of your explanations. I found some explanations in our literature, but they are not so convincing. Does God really forbid such things, or is this a Watchtower addition? Well, God obviously doesn't say anything about not clinking glasses together or toasting someone. But the Watchtower seems to think that toasting has religious connections going back to, you know, paganism. And so Jehovah's Witnesses have it in their mind that that's not the proper thing to do. It does make Jehovah's Witnesses seem a little bit kooky for, I don't know, what did Solomon say? You know, don't be righteous over much. You know, raising your glass to someone who's, you know, maybe in your office, you go out after work, they just gotten a promotion, and here, congratulations. And someone who's not a Jehovah's Witness is standing, no, I can't do that because raising a glass, toasting it. I mean, it brings a reproach, I think, upon the truth that someone would make an issue out of that. Because people now, I mean, perhaps it obviously in times past, people would raise a glass to their gods, but people don't do that now. But there are obviously a lot of things like this. And it's sort of a complicated issue because if you are one of Jehovah's Witnesses and you're in a situation where there's a toast or whatever, and there are other witnesses around, and you feel it's proper, you don't have a problem with it. But, you know, Paul talked about not eating meat if it offended his brother. So you have to take into consideration the conscience of your brother. But there is another issue that Bible prophecy addresses. And, you know, the book of Isaiah, it speaks to the Israelites, but I think as many of you suspect, and as I've written, it really applies to those who would be God's people, Christians, during the run-up to the return of Christ and the actual judgment of God. So these ancient prophecies are really Jehovah's judicial decisions yet to be levied against his people. And in the 28th chapter of Isaiah, Jehovah addresses the leadership of his people, calling them the drunkards of Ephraim. And it goes on, it says, even the priest and the prophet, they've all gone astray because of intoxicating liquor. Well, it's not talking about literal booze, but a person can be spiritually intoxicated. And I think the leadership of Jehovah's Witnesses is, they're so full of the, you know, we know the truth, we are God's organization, and they're intoxicated with their own perceived power and knowledge. But it goes on in verse 9, God says, whom will one instruct in knowledge, and whom will one make understand what has been heard? Those who have been weaned from the milk and moved away from the breasts? For it is, and this is what the attitude of these drunken priests, command upon command, measuring line upon measuring line, measuring line upon measuring line, here a little, there a little. So that, from God's perspective, is how the leaders of his people teach God's people, as if they were children. And apparently in Hebrew, that verse had a lilt to it, sort of as a sing-song nursery rhyme. And it really does apply to the watchtower. You know, it used to drive me crazy. Every year, a few months before the district convention, there would always be a service meeting part discussing the same thing about, you know, lapel cards and proper grooming and the motel and command upon command, here a little, there a little. You know, do you get the sense of it? Yes, the watchtower has made up rules, commands, measuring lines, and the coming flood will wash all of that away along with their 1914 false story. And then we'll see who has the faith and who doesn't. And that's what the judgment will determine. All right, let's open up another one here. Okay. It says, I don't normally write in questions, so this is an extraordinary week. It said, because this is actually my second write-in question for your consideration. He says, I was intrigued, or better yet, horrified is a better word, by the possibilities that the Watchtower's president opened up. Is it possible that this is the opportunity that Satan and the man of lawlessness have been waiting for? Surely there are procedures in place for picking a new president. I don't know enough about such things to say for certain, though, how the new president is determined. Could this be the catalyst for the disgusting thing to stand where it ought not, as the president of the very organization that leads Jehovah's people? This would certainly fulfill Bible prophecy in a more profound way than anything I had anticipated before. Your thoughts on the matter would be appreciated. Well, he's referring to the passing of Max Larson. But actually, as far as the man of lawlessness, I don't think it's an individual. In fact, I'm certain it isn't, because the man of lawlessness has been in operation for more than a generation. The man of lawlessness promotes the fake parousia, according to the, you know, the context of Paul's remarks there. He would issue these authoritative-like pronouncements regarding that the day of Jehovah is here and the presence has begun and all of that, which is exactly what the Watchtower has been doing for well over 100 years. So I think it's a class of individuals that are promoting this, probably Masons that have infiltrated the organization, satanic agents. It is interesting, though, back in the around 93, I believe it was, the governing body made an announcement at the end of a Watchtower study article saying that they were no longer going to be running the organization, that all the governing body was going to consider was the teaching, the doctrinal matters. And from then on, non-anointed individuals would run the Watchtower Society, the corporation, its day-to-day operations. And ever since then, we can see, you know, the Watchtower has become more and more worldly and more like, you know, any sort of business corporation. It's run by lawyers and accountants, and they make decisions, right? We see that the NGO connection, the way that they've tried to crush the plaintiff legal claims of sexual abuse victims, secret payouts, and now just recently they're attending hedge fund meetings and rubbing shoulders with all the big bankers and hedge fund managers. It's just disgusting, and they're still, you know, lobbying with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and they have become just like any business, really. And that is, I think, it was ominous back and when that they signed that away, because now the governing body has no power over this Watchtower Society. It's run by a board of directors, and I would imagine the president is himself more or less a figurehead. The real power of any corporation is the board of directors. So again, I mean, we're going to see when Christ arrives, his manifestation will expose the evil within. And that will be that, won't it? Okay. He says, hi, my name's Richard. I've been watching your vodcast, listening to your podcast for the last couple of weeks. You've convinced me that you have the truth by your reasoning. So if I may, I would like to ask a biblical question about Lazarus, which I've had for years and can never find an answer. In Romans 6:23, it says that the wages sin pays is death. And then Romans 6:7 says, for he who has died has been acquitted from his sin. When Jesus resurrected Lazarus, did his sin still remain? Well, that is an interesting question. The answer is, it doesn't matter, or it didn't matter. There were several people that were resurrected before Lazarus, and so what if their sin didn't remain? They were still sinners, and they, you know, accumulated some more sin, right? Actually, when Paul said he who has died has been acquitted from his sin, he was speaking to anointed persons who were baptized into Christ. They died as to their former self, and in that sense, they had been acquitted of their sin. Now, we know that there are those who were resurrected first, and the second death has no authority over them. They're resurrected as sinless, immortal, incorruptible spirits. So in that sense, when they die, they have been totally acquitted. In fact, from, like I say, from their baptism into Christ, they've been acquitted. But for those who are to be resurrected onto the earth, they're going to be resurrected in a sinful state. It's just that they will not be held accountable for the sins they committed prior to their death. In Revelation, the 20th chapter, where it talks about the resurrection, and it says scrolls were opened, apparently the scrolls of their former life, but it says other scrolls were opened, and they were judged out of those scrolls. In other words, they will be judged according to what they do after the resurrection. That's what Jesus said, that those who practice vile things in this world will receive a resurrection of judgment. They'll be on probation, right, to see if they respond to Christ, if they obey Christ, if they make an effort to reform themselves. Then they will be acquitted of their sin. But if not, then they're still subject to the second death. Okay. I would like to hear your thoughts on 10:28. Just maybe the witnesses got this wrong. I don't think so. Matthew 10:28, that's where Jesus said, "Do not be fearful of him that can only kill the body but not the soul, but be in fear of him who can destroy both body and soul in Gehenna." And obviously many people do not understand this, people that have been indoctrinated with this notion of, you know, an immortal soul and eternal torment. This scripture just is incontrovertible proof that there is such a place as a burning fiery hell. Of course, Jehovah's Witnesses know that Gehenna was a garbage dump outside of Jerusalem, and they threw refuse there and animal carcasses, and they also apparently threw dead bodies there of criminals whom they considered unworthy of a proper burial and figured they probably wouldn't be resurrected anyway. So it was a horrible place. They would throw big chunks of sulfur there to keep the fires burning, and that's what Jesus referred to it as, where the maggot doesn't die and the fire burned perpetually. But if you note there, it doesn't say anything about the soul being undying. It's saying that God can destroy both body and soul in Gehenna. So being destroyed, that means gone, dead, forever, no resurrection. Jesus is contrasting two types of death, and that's really the point. Temporary death and permanent death. If we're faithful to God and we lose our life, men inflict upon us a temporary death. Jehovah will bring us back to life. If we're unfaithful to God, he may inflict a permanent death upon us, as if throwing both our body and our soul or our future life's prospects into the fires of Gehenna. So in that context, Jesus was using soul as a way of speaking about future life's prospect, you know, to be able to live again as a human, as a living soul. And men cannot take that away from us. Only God can. So Christ was telling us, don't be afraid of men, be in fear of Jehovah, and don't displease him so that we're not destroyed permanently. Okay, this is the last part of a question. He says, I know from personal experience. He'd made some comments on pornography, and then he said, I know from personal experience that dwelling on immoral thoughts can lead to no good, but is it okay to mentally engage in sexual fantasies for the express purpose of relieving pent-up sexual energy and tension through masturbation, with the intent of ultimately clearing the mind so that one can be more focused on other things? Well, no. According to scriptures, were to think upon things that are chaste and pure and praiseworthy, not engage in sexual fantasies. You can't really appease the flesh by giving into it. Paul said you put the desires of the flesh to death by the Spirit. And Jesus advised on the Sermon on the Mount, you know, if your right eye offends you, pluck it out. If your right hand offends you, cut it off. It's better to be maimed or blind and go into life than to be thrown into Gehenna with all your members. There's that word Gehenna again. So God expects us to put up a fight against immoral desires, and he gives us the power to do so through his Holy Spirit, provided that we avail ourselves of it. So I hope that answers your question. I have a follow-up question from last week. He actually called in, but I'm not going to put the whole thing online. I had made a comment about experiences I had before I came into the truth with the demons, and he was concerned that I was experiencing some sort of delusion. And maybe I didn't express myself clearly enough. He had commented that I had seen an apparition. And that's not what I said. I didn't see any sort of thing or hallucinate. But I did have contact with the wicked spirits, and there was no denying. I mean, I'm not going to go into detail. I don't think it's encouraging. In fact, I wish I hadn't brought it up, to be honest with you. It is hard for people to understand who've never had experience with that sort of thing, and especially if you tell them that there were drugs involved, and they say, well, yeah, of course, drugs, you know, you're in a – and that's not how it works. You know, in the scriptures, the word spiritism in English is taken from the Greek word pharmakia, and that's where our English words pharmacy and pharmaceuticals come from. But spiritism, of course, is contact with spirits, with demons. Well, why does it use the word pharmakia? Because drugs, natural drugs, have been used for centuries by people, shamans and witch doctors and so forth, Native Americans and Native peoples around the world, because it puts them in a state of mind that opens their mind up to communication with the spirit world. Peyote from cactus, or mescaline, or psilocybin mushrooms, and all of that sort of thing. And then, of course, there's this synthetic LSD and other hallucinogenics. The way I look at it, you know, our mind has brain waves, right? And certain frequencies, you might say, and drugs, certain drugs, dial up our mind into certain frequencies, like tuning a radio, you know, and we come across a channel, you know, and it might be music or news or whatever. But in our mind, we can tune into a frequency that the demons can speak, and they do. I think most people, that doesn't mean that everybody does it. Hallucinogenic or marijuana or something is going to automatically, you know, get into that situation. But it does make a person much more susceptible to being influenced. And I think a lot of people don't even realize it. They have experiences with drugs and you know, maybe have not realized what they were dealing with. People that have, you know, supposedly been beamed up into UFOs and inspected by aliens and so forth. Obviously. Hold on, I'm getting a call right now. That's going to do it for me. I'm a little bit distracted with stuff going on, and I hope to talk to you again soon, though. And until then, may Jehovah bless you. Search for the truth. We'll be right back.